Chapter 23. Revis watched the new arrivals get to work. Once the chamber was secured, they brought over equipment from their hovering gunship, power units, long-range comms bundles, heavy coils of ammunition. They moved quickly, methodically, barely saying a word to one another. Some of what they did was just insane. Their gunship remained at station a few meters out from the comms tower, its massive engines burning hard. In order to retrieve some of the heavier items, the Space Marines would casually leap across the gap, momentarily suspended hundreds of meters up, before coming back the same way, heavy equipment swinging in their fists that would have torn his muscles just a lift. Soon the chamber was fully lit again, its equipment pulsing with power. One of the warriors consulted with Hegain, summoning up fresh hololithic schemas of the labyrinth within. The one who had called himself Haesler, a sergeant of the 3rd Company by his markings, spoke with Spinoza. Revis got up, feeling the stiffness in his limbs, and went over to them.
"The outer fortress is completely overrun," Spinoza was telling Haesler. "The inner sanctuary seems to have been sealed off, but that may not help if the corrupted gain access to the main power generators."
The Imperial Fist nodded, studying the hololiths.
"Those can be secured here," he said, pointing to a narrow choke point many levels down, close to where the psionic conduits docked with the main citadel. "But we'll need to get inside the center, too."
"My master, Inquisitor Crowell, aimed to reach the cordon before they shut the doors. He believed the master of the Astronomicon was in there."
"Then we shall endeavor to reach both of them."
Just listening to the Space Marine speak gave Revis a curious kind of reassurance. It was not a gentle voice. It was bone-hard, perfunctory, the kind of voice that had been giving orders for decades. But it was solid, where all else around them seemed to be collapsing into flux. If warriors such as these could be mobilized in numbers, if they still had their vigor and faith when all others lost theirs, then it became possible to believe the situation was still salvageable. Revis had served for 8 years in Salvator. In that time, he had proven equal to anything the throne world had hurled up at him. Now, in quick succession, fate had thrown him alongside different warrior species of legend, each capable of performing feats that dwarfed anything he could hope to achieve. If this constituted some kind of providential injunction to remember his place in the scheme of things, the lesson was at risk of being quite heavily overstated. Spinoza, in contrast, carried herself with a freedom that he had seldom seen since her arrival at Corvain. In her full battle plate, carrying her Crozius, she did not look much out of place alongside the giants of the Adeptus Astartes. When they spoke to her, it was almost as if they spoke to one of their own.
"Ready, Captain?" she asked him.
The stormtroopers who had made it into the chamber were still capable of fighting. All of them were on their feet again now, recharging, reloading, flexing fatigue-tight limbs.
"On your command, Lord," Revis said. "We shall need to move swiftly," Haesler said, motioning for his squad to take up position before the shattered doors.
He glanced at Revis.
"You must try to keep up."
Revis smiled dryly under his helm.
"We'll do our best."
Then the Imperial Fists moved off into the gap. Haesler led the assault, barging aside the tattered sheets of metal and plunging into the dark. Once on the far side, everything changed. Their progress previously had been a matter of running for cover, seizing any islands of protection they could find before fleeing onward again. This was entirely different. The Space Marines made no attempt to hide, no attempt to trace hidden and torturous routes, but burned the straightest path towards their goal, contemptuous of danger. They split into 2 squads of 5. The 2nd squad headed down towards the fortress's principal power converter, buried deep where the psionic trench met the inner walls. Spinoza, Revis, and the other survivors went with Haesler and 4 of his battle brothers, and together they struck out towards the center. Their presence soon attracted attention. The dregs and scraps of the corrupted screamed up out of the pits and vaults towards them, throwing themselves at the armored monsters who had violated their realm. The Space Marines took the brunt of every assault, never slowing, sheltering the stormtroopers with their own bodies and loosing bolter fire in vicious, unrestrained volleys. Revis, as promised, did his best to keep up. He contributed, when he could, adding his hellgun shots to the thundering chorus of bolt guns.
Amid all the broken shadows and fire-flecked explosions, even through his fatigue, he witnessed the way the Adeptus Astartes fought, and for the first time began to understand why Spinoza was so enamored with them. They were so different to the custodians. Where those warriors had been artisans of combat, individually perfect, beautiful and dreadful, these were ostensibly cruder creations, blunter-edged, heavier. Soon, though, it became apparent that they were no less deadly. Their way of battle was to overwhelm, to shock, to render an opponent half insensible before the first blows even landed. Within that rolling tide of sensory overload, fueled by battle roars and the incessant grind of servos and muzzle flares, there was another kind of artistry present, a pinpoint precision, a flawless awareness of those around them. They were a seamless unit, the five of them, backing one another up, multiplying the other's firepower and killing potential. As Rivas ran, he felt the long tug of exhaustion snag at his muscles. The pace, as promised, was punishing. The Space Marines scorched their way back through blood-streaked halls, never pausing, tearing through hastily thrown psychic bolts as if they were nothing. Spinoza remained at the forefront, running alongside Hessler, guiding them in. They reached a long, arched bridge that crossed a deep chasm and sprinted across it. Screams swung at them eerily, some far below, some above. Rivas gritted his teeth and kept going, feeling the sharp burn in his lungs. An Imperial fist loped alongside him, his heavy boots cracking the stone with each footfall. The corrupted adept came from nowhere. It must have been waiting for them on the underside of the bridge, hanging like a spider, poised to drag itself up over the edge. It slithered quickly into view, cloaked in snaggles of darkness, its toothless jaw locked into a snarl. The Space Marine reacted instantly, bringing his bolter to bear. But reality suddenly popped around them, wobbling and distorting. He slipped, skidding close to the edge. Rivas, running just a little further back, opened up with his Hellgun. Lasbeams sliced into the adept, every one hitting home, cutting straight through it and punching streamers of blood out the far side. He found himself shouting in rage, just as the Space Marines did, hurling invective at the creature, even as its psychic distortion gusted out. A second later, and the Imperial fist had recovered himself. He lurched forward, grabbing the wretch by its neck and hurling it out into the void. Then he turned on Rivas, his helm lenses glowing in the fractured dark. For a moment, Rivas thought the warrior would be angry, deprived of prey.
"How long have you been in here?" the Space Marine demanded.
Rivas glanced at the mission chrono.
5.4 hours, Lord," he replied.
The enormous helm nodded in salute.
"Impressive," he said. "You do honor to the throne."
He turned back, running again, racing to catch up with the rest of the squad. Rivas stood for a split second, startled, panting, aching.
"You do honor to the throne."
Then he too was running again, somehow feeling less pain than before, somehow dragging energy up from a place he had not yet tapped. His jaw set firm, his shoulders low, he kept his legs moving, rejoining the band as it tore deeper into the heart of the fortress. The Space Marines were still roaring battle chants, creating that wall of sonic intimidation that travelled before them like a physical shockwave.
"For him!"
Rivas cried out, joining in the charge, feeling the energy of it flood through his body, banishing both the dark and the agony.
"For the glory of him on earth!"
Kral glanced back, just for a moment, at Khazad. She appeared to be listening to the resonance while staring all the while intently at the master. The expression of pure hatred in her eyes was impressive. If the resonance had not been on hand to keep her in check, he had little doubt the man would already have been dead at her hands, power blade or no. He turned back to his host. The void below yawned away beneath him, and the eddies of the sphere's internal winds pulled at his cloak.
"What happened here?" Kral asked.
"It can be contained," said Frank.
"Have you been outside?"
"It can be contained."
Frank gazed up at the pulsating orb.
"A new alignment is coming, Inquisitor. A new age. We must expect birth pangs."
Kral followed the man's eyes. He had no means of judging, but the oscillations out in the center of the sphere looked febrile to him, as if something was out of kilter. Even as he watched, black blotches appeared and disappeared in its heart, bursting and fading like blood clots.
"You have lost your acolytes to madness," Kral tried again. "The few left alive are mindless wretches. This is more than an alignment."
Frank sucked in a long breath through his device, making it wheeze.
"You and I are both old men. We have seen a great deal, but nothing compared to what must come now."
He turned and fixed the Inquisitor with two deep green eyes.
"I come here from the Senatorum. We nearly changed a law there that has stood for 10,000 years, one that has underpinned everything we have done since the days of glory. I argued against it, and for now it stands. But as for the future, who knows? There are agitated souls out there now. They have reason to be. We have lost Cadia."
Kral thought he must have misheard that.
We have lost Cadia."
The Master smiled again, coldly.
"That will concentrate minds. Some of them should have been concentrated far earlier."
"What is the wound?"
"Ah, you heard them scream that, did you? That was the first inkling we had that something was wrong. They started writing it in their scriptorium classes over and over. Then we couldn't stop them saying it. Then they started reaching for knives."
"You should have reported it."
"It can be contained."
Kral snorted. The orb above them flexed again, blotching black before clearing.
"You know it can't.
There is a boundary between the ether and real space. It can be bent. It can be broken. In the usual run of things, breakages are localized, impermanent. But Cadia was important, and there were more than just physical walls on that world. The wound is the mark of our failure. I do not know yet how large it will grow. It may never stop growing."
"And it is sending your people mad."
"They are attuned to the warp as few others are."
Kral remembered what Spinoza had said then. His words to her in that final chamber seemed like some strange dream, a fever nightmare, and he could hardly believe he'd uttered them.
"You need assistance. You need help. The beacon will be lost."
"How did you get in here, Kral? I thought our tracks had been covered adequately well, given the limitations of time and resources."
Kral stared at him for a moment, wondering how he could be quite so phlegmatic. His entire kingdom was on the verge of destruction. Even as he hesitated, a few more of the light points on the sphere's edge went dark, provoking more spasms from the central orb.
"You took your inspiration from heresy," Kral said.
"Appropriately enough. I thought the Magister was merely mad, but its final words had a ring to them. I had heard something similar before, or maybe read it. It took me a while to remember, for my mind does not seem to be what it was, but it came to me in the end. I had a single copy of the Forbidden Manuscript, written before this world had a single language. Mine was in the Dwatjer dialect, and transliterated after a little work to Offenbarung, or in the Gothic, Revelation.
A suitably obscure passage to choose as your code phrase. And before the throne there was a sea of glass, like unto crystal."
Frank nodded.
"And in the midst of the throne, and round about the throne, were four beasts, full of eyes, before and behind." The text was not picked idly.
"Rassilo told me the same thing. The throne is failing."
"And we were the beasts that stood about it, the only ones to see and understand the danger. Danda, Raskian, myself."
"And the fourth?"
You have met it, I believe. That creature is dead.
Frank laughed.
Come now, you know that isn't true.
The orb trembled, and black sparks shot from its heart. A tongue of flame kindled in the air above them, snapping briefly, like a pennant before gusting out. A tremor ran across the earth far below them, core deep and angry.
Tell me what you have done, Kral said.
Frank clasped his hands together again, turning his face up to the light show above.
It is already complete, Inquisitor. Bringing the Xenos here was our greatest mistake, but it had insisted on seeing the throne world in person. In truth, the main outline of the project had already been agreed. When the creature went mad, that was regrettable and momentarily dangerous, but it did not affect the matter of the scheme. Danda pulled out, which was a shame, but her role was always peripheral.
Kral listened, suppressing the 100 questions that simmered under the surface.
They can help us. Without them, the throne will not see out the next 100 years. It will go dark, poisoned both by age and the coming wound in reality. You do not know what that means. You do not know what the throne truly is, nor what it protects us from. You may believe in your ignorance that it is immune to harm, or that its failures can somehow be accommodated. But let me tell you, with the utmost surety, born of perception of what lies beneath, that the horrors you have seen in here this night pale into nothing beside what would overtake us if it were allowed to fail.
They are liars, Kral said.
The Xenos? Most assuredly so.
They will betray us. They care nothing for us.
The Master shrugged.
The second point is certainly true. The first point may be true also. Risk exists in everything we do.
Kral had to restrain himself from leaping up then, clawing at the man's throat. He still had sanguine at his belt. If he moved quickly enough, before the thought fully formed.
What have you given them?
That is none of your concern.
You sold out your own species, Kral shouted. That makes it my concern.
The flesh at the corner of Frank's eyes flickered a fraction.
No price could be too high, he said, defensive now, if it succeeded.
Kral edged closer to him, holding himself back with some difficulty.
They are abominations, he hissed. Nothing they have told you can be trusted. Whatever you have promised them will be lost forever. They live only for pain, our pain.
Frank rounded on him then, at last showing defiance.
Yes, we are prey to them, he said, his voice low and bitter. We always have been. And yet, if we are destroyed, then they understand that they must be next, for it is we, the weak, the deluded, the decaying children of old Earth, who alone hold back the tide of unmaking. We are bound together in our mutual need.
Kral stared into the Master's eyes, and saw the utter certainty there. At the very least, the man believed what he said.
Whatever you have done, he said, his voice low, call it back.
Frank smiled again, this time with a certain sadness in his eyes.
I could not do so now, even if I wished it, he said. You have been a most dogged pursuer, Kral. I find myself pleased that you did not die in your lonely citadel, and that we have spoken these words. But the delegation has left. They are no longer on Terra. They take with them the final element of the project, the very last thing they asked of us, and when they reach their destination, the contract will be sealed. It cannot be stopped now.
Kral tried to move then, to reach for his revolver, but found he couldn't. With a rising sense of panic, he found that his limbs were frozen, weighed down as if in liquid rockcrete. He could still move his eyes. Above them, the orb was pluming more violently. It looked as if, far above them, a crack had formed in the glass. He tried to blurt out a warning, but his lips were clamped together.
"We must endure now," the master said. "We must wait and ride out the coming storm."
Kral felt a twitch at his belt and saw with horror that Sanguine was moving of its own accord from his holster. Out of the corner of his eye, he could see Khazad similarly locked in place, though struggling hard.
"I have sacrificed everything to see this come to pass," Frank said.
Above them, more flames licked into life, dancing like ghosts around the cold star at their heart.
"You understand me. Everything."
Sanguine rose up smoothly before Kral, swiveling on its axis, until the barrel was lined up against his forehead. He struggled to move, and knew that the strength he had left in his withered limbs was laughably insufficient. Sanguine floated closer, the muzzle's tip pressing lightly against his skin.
"The new age is upon us," the master said. "I find myself sorry, truly sorry, that you will not live to see it." With nothing left to do, Kral closed his eyes.